Why did he do it? After Jesus finished the Last Supper with his disciples in the upper room, he headed out with the apostles, and they crossed the Kidron Valley, and they came to a garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. The garden was full of olive trees, and it had a hillside. And there he told his disciples, I want you to stay here and watch and pray. Then he went a little bit farther with Peter, James, and John, and then a little bit farther by himself, and he fell to the ground, and he began to pray to the Father. And he said, Father, if it's at all possible, please remove this cup from me. Most likely he's referring to the future sufferings that he was going to experience. And he was asking, God, if there is a way at all, if there's some kind of escape route to where I don't have to experience these sufferings, then please remove this cup from me. And then he concluded the prayer with, not my will, but yours be done. And why did he do it? Not too much longer after that prayer, sometime in the middle of the evening, a company of soldiers came to the Garden of Gethsemane. That company of soldiers had weapons and torches. Judas Iscariot was leading the way. And what's so fascinating about the situation is that Jesus saw them coming, and instead of hiding, instead of running away, instead of trying to evade arrest, it says that he actually walked towards the soldiers. The soldiers said, are you Jesus of Nazareth? And he said, I am he. And it says the soldiers immediately drew back. They were cowering in fear. And no doubt, if Jesus had commenced an attack at that moment, if he had told the disciples, let's go ahead and attack these soldiers, I want you to fight for me, that they probably would have won, because the soldiers were more afraid of the one they were arresting than the one who was there. Jesus was afraid of them. And yet Jesus didn't do that. He let them take him captive under their arrest. And why did he do that? Why did he do it? The first place where those soldiers took Jesus was to the house of Annas, and then from there they took him to be before Caiaphas, the high priest. And there he stood trial. And the trial wasn't a fair trial. They brought false witnesses who brought false accusations against Jesus. And it was obvious that those accusations were false because their testimony didn't agree. There was inconsistencies in the things that they were saying. And surely, if Jesus had spoken up at that moment and began to defend himself in the midst of that trial, that he would have been able to go free. He could have said, listen, you don't even have anything on me. You can't even get your witnesses to agree. You have nothing to bring before me. They would have had to drop the charges and he would have been able to go. But instead, the whole time during the trial, as he heard these false accusations, he stood there silent. Until finally Caiaphas turned to him and asked a very direct question and said, are you the Christ, the Son of the living God? And if there ever was a time for Jesus to evade a question, if there ever was a time for Jesus to respond with a question, as he often did in his discussions with the Pharisees, if there ever was a time for him to offer some kind of rhetorical, some kind of philosophical answer, it would have been here. But instead, Jesus answers that direct question with a very direct answer. And he says, it is as you say. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power coming with the angels. And immediately Caiaphas turned and he tore his clothes. And he said, what more do we have to say? This man is worthy of death. At the very moment in the trial when Jesus could have defended himself, he was silent. And at the very moment when, if he wanted to save his life, he should have been silent, he spoke directly, knowing that the answer that he gave was signing his death warrant. And why did he do it? The Jewish leaders then took him to Pilate. They couldn't execute someone without the authority of the Romans, so they had to take him to the governor of that area, which was Pilate at that time. And Pilate saw through the Jewish hypocrisy. He understood what was going on. he saw that this was an internal dispute. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so he started to try to find a way to let Jesus go free quietly. And the first way that he tried to do this was he sent Jesus to Herod. Herod had some jurisdiction in Galilee. Jesus was from Galilee. And so he thought, maybe Herod can take care of the situation. We'll send him to Herod. And Herod was excited to know that Jesus was going to come and see him because he had heard of Jesus, heard of some of the miracles that he had performed, heard of some of the things that he had taught. And so he was excited to have Jesus there with him. And surely, if Jesus had come to Herod and had performed a few miracles, indulged Herod with a few magic tricks, said some things that made Herod laugh or made him wonder, if he had just indulged Herod just a little bit, surely Herod would have let him go free. But instead of doing that, when Jesus came to Herod, he simply did not say a word. He didn't perform any miracles, didn't do any tricks, didn't answer any questions. He was silent. This infuriated Herod, made him extremely mad, told his soldiers to go and ridicule Jesus. They put a purple robe around him and began to mock him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And all that could have been avoided if Jesus had simply indulged Herod with some kind of miracle, but he did not do that. And why did he do it? Why did he remain silent? The second way that Pilate tried then to let Jesus go free quietly was then to offer someone for the crowd to be set free. And so he brings before the crowd Barabbas. And Barabbas was a rebellious murderer. And I'm sure Pilate was thinking, there's no way that this crowd is going to let Barabbas go free because he's a rebellious murderer. And so I'll put Barabbas and I'll put Jesus, and surely the crowd will then choose Jesus. But to Pilate's dismay, as the crowd sees the two options of Barabbas and Jesus, the crowd starts chanting, "Give us Barabbas. Give us Barabbas." But what's so fascinating to me about the whole scenario is that Jesus never needed to be in that situation at all. If Jesus simply had begun to defend his innocence before Pilate, if he had simply tried to bribe Pilate, as was often the custom, to get himself to go free, or if he had tried to simply explain to Pilate, "Let me just explain the situation to you. These Jews don't understand what's going on. It's just a big misunderstanding," that Pilate most assuredly would have let him go free. But Jesus didn't do any of that. He didn't try to defend. He didn't try to bribe. He didn't try to do anything to explain his situation to Pilate in that manner. Instead, he let the things play out. He stood there before the crowd, and he heard them chanting, "Give us Barabbas, give us Barabbas." And why did he do that? Why did he do it? So finally, Pilate tries a third opportunity to try to let Jesus go free in a quiet manner. He thinks, maybe if I punish Jesus, that the crowd will see him beaten and bloodied and will then offer him pity. And so he gives the orders for Jesus to be flogged, to be whipped. Normally when they would do a whipping of this kind, they would take the victim and they would tie him to a post, and then there would be about two or three soldiers who would stand on the outside, and they would take turns, one by one, throwing a whip across the back. That whip would be like a flagellum. It would have nine tails attached to it, which would have bone and glass and rock and things like that. And they would rake that thing across the back. According to tradition, there have been 39 lashes that Jesus would have experienced. At the end of that whipping, he would have lost a whole lot of blood, been incredibly weak. They then take Jesus. They get a crown of thorns that they weave. They put it on top of his head. They wrap that purple robe around Jesus again. They stand him up before the crowd. And Pilate says, "Behold, the King of the Jews." And there Jesus stands. He's beaten and he's bloodied. He's weak incredibly. He's got a crown of thorns. He's got a purple robe around him. And the crowd sees him and they begin to shout out and chant, "Crucify him. Crucify him. Crucify him." And surely, if Jesus had simply begun to plead with the crowd, if he had just to explain to them, "I'm really king. I'm really God in the flesh. You don't understand what you're doing." If he had simply tried to reason with the crowd, surely the crowd would have understood. Surely the crowd would have had pity. But instead, Jesus doesn't do that at all. He stands there, silent, listening as the crowd is declaring they want him to be crucified. And why did he do it? Why did he do it? So finally, Pilate gives in. He sits down at the seat of pavement, takes some water, washes his hands, and he says, "His blood is not on me." He gives into the crowd and he says, "Take him away to be crucified." Typical manner of execution through crucifixion would require the victim to carry the horizontal beam of the cross to the place of execution. That beam would weigh maybe about 75 to 125 pounds. And it shows you how weak Jesus was at this point, that as he tried to carry that beam, he couldn't make it. Instead, with the help of Simon of Cyrene, they finally were able to carry that beam to the place called Golgotha, place of the skull. And there they took that beam, they put it down, and Jesus was outstretched on that beam, and those soldiers took nails about 5 to 7 inches long, and they dug them probably into his wrist, one on his right, one on his left, one on his feet, nailed him to that cross, lifted that cross up, and for the first time his body hung there against those nails. When someone was crucified, it was an execution that would experience a lot of pain because you couldn't breathe and you'd have to push yourself against those nails with your hands and feet to try to breathe, and it'd be really, really painful and hard. But another part of crucifixion, maybe a part we don't talk about as much, is that crucifixion was very shameful. It was very shameful. That was the whole point of it all, to create shame for the victim. And so they would put a cross, or the person being crucified, they would put them in a public location so that people would be walking by and they'd see this person, they'd see the terrible things they've done and the consequences they were receiving for it, and that would bring that person shame who's being crucified. And so no doubt, as Jesus is hanging on the cross, there are people passing by, looking at Jesus, casting insults at him, making him feel shame and embarrassment, and people were saying things like, "You know, if you're the Christ, then come down and we'll believe you. If you're the Son of God, just come down from the cross. You saved others. Save yourself." And what's so ironic about all of that is that we know the full story and that Jesus could have done that. He could have called it all off and said, "Father, enough of this." He could have called 10,000 angels, as we sometimes sing. He could have made it all end immediately, exactly whenever he wanted it to. And yet he stayed there, endured the shame, endured the embarrassment, endured the ridicule, until finally, after 6 hours, his body lasted 6 hours. Maybe because of the blood loss, maybe because of just a broken heart, Jesus said, "Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit." And God in the flesh, Son of God, died. And why did he do it? Why? And we could theologize and philosophize a number of different answers to that question. But I'm convinced, with all my heart, that the fundamental answer to that question is found in 1 John 3:16. This is how we know what love is: that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. That's the reason why he prayed, "Not my will, but your will be done." That's the reason why he walked towards the soldiers in the garden instead of running away or hiding. That's the reason why he stood there silent in the trial as he heard those false accusations. That's the reason why he didn't say anything to Herod. That's the reason why he never groveled at Pilate's feet. That's the reason why he never reasoned with the crowd. That's the reason why he endured all the pain. That's the reason why he accepted the shame. That's the reason why he died. Because he loved us. He knew that sin and evil was too great. He knew that our world, the world that God had created, was experiencing the effects and consequences of sin. It was holding us captive. And he wanted us to be set free. He wanted us to have new life. And he knew that in order for that to happen, it was going to have to occur through suffering and death. And so he said, I'll do it. I'll do it. And the picture of Jesus enduring suffering and death is not of someone who is weak, church. It's not of someone who is desperate. It is not of someone who is scared or embarrassed or afraid. The picture of Jesus experiencing the sufferings and the death on the cross is of someone with great power, with great authority, with great honor, who lays that down because he loved us. And if he had to do that because he was being forced to, we would call that oppression. If he was doing that because he deserved it, we would call that justice. But if he did that because he chose to, because he chose to, we call that love. We call that love. And because of that, I can assure you that there's one question that you never have to wonder about, one question you ever have to question, one question you never have to doubt. Does God love me? Because no matter what you've done, no matter who you are, no matter where you've been, no matter what mistakes or failures you have been in your life or that you've experienced in your life, I can tell you that the answer to that question is a complete yes. Because Jesus Christ chose to suffer and die because he loved you so. If Jesus had remained dead, there wouldn't be any Christmas. If Jesus' body was still in the tomb, we wouldn't celebrate the fact that he has come to this earth. Maybe we would think he was a good man. Maybe we would think that he would have some good teachings that we ought to listen to. Maybe we would think he was a good philosopher, possibly, someone who did a lot of good things for other people. But we wouldn't celebrate the coming of Jesus to earth because it would have been a tragic story with a tragic ending. Good man who just fell victim to the problems of the world and died an unfortunate death. But we believe that that's not the end of the story, right? We believe that very early on a Sunday morning, there was a group of women, and they were going to the tomb to anoint Jesus' body with spices and perfumes. And they were wondering on the way, as how are we going to roll this stone away? How are we going to do this? But sure enough, when they get to the tomb, they find out that the stone actually has already been rolled away. And there's an angel there dressed in white. And the angel, just like the angels said at the birth of Jesus, the angel says, "Do not be afraid, for you have come to see Jesus who was crucified, but he's not here, for he has arisen." Surely the hearts of those women jumped a beat when they heard that phrase. They go back to Jerusalem to tell the apostles of what they've seen and what they've heard. And Peter and John jump up, just like those shepherds that went into Bethlehem to see what had happened, to see the baby that had been born. Peter and John jump up and they go to the tomb to see, is it really true? We got to see it with our hands, or see it with our eyes, feel it with our hands. And they go into that tomb and they see there is no body. There is not a dead body there. He is alive. And that evening, as the apostles, except for Thomas, were gathered in a room that evening, Jesus appears and he shows them, "I'm not dead anymore. I'm alive. Believe." And ever since that day, the world has never been the same, right? Ever since that day, every first day of the week, every Sunday, Christians have gathered to praise Jesus, to do what we've done today, to celebrate the birth, life, and death, and resurrection of Jesus, to share in communion. They've done it ever since then. Because the fact that Jesus is raised from the dead means that we have hope. We have hope every single day. We have hope. No matter where you are in your life, you've got hope. You have hope because Jesus conquered the grave. And that means that sin and death cannot conquer us. Sin and death is not going to have the final outcome. We know the final outcome is that God is going to win because he won at the grave. And if he won at the grave, he can win in my heart too. And so every day I can know that through the resurrecting power of Jesus, he can work in my life and I can conquer sin and I can conquer death. And I don't have to be afraid of death because I know there will be a resurrection someday. And it's because of that that we have an invitation. It's because that Jesus came and he lived and he died and he's alive that we have an invitation. And the invitation is, come follow Jesus. Come follow the man who was born in Bethlehem. Come follow the one who healed the sick, caused the blind to see, caused the dead to be raised, caused the lame to walk. Come follow the man who shared the body and the blood with his apostles in the upper room. Come follow the man who chose to suffer and die for you. Come follow the man who is now alive, who's been raised from the dead. Come follow the one who gives us joy and peace, who offers us sacrificial love and enduring hope. Come follow the one who is the true Son of God. And the way that we make that decision to follow him is by repenting of our sins and being baptized into Christ. And if you're ready to be baptized, what a wonderful Christmas present that would be to experience that. And during this song, just come to the front and we'll baptize you into Christ. You'll experience the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus and begin walking with him. Maybe you need prayer this morning. Our shepherds are going to surround this building. You just walk to one of our shepherds, and they'll pray with you and encourage you in any way that they can. Let's stand and let's sing at this time.